The trouble sprang naturally out of the government's order to the anarchists to surrender their arms. In the English press, this was translated into English terms and took this form, that arms were desperately needed on the Aragon front and could not be sent there because the unpatriotic anarchists were holding them back. To put it like this is to ignore the conditions actually existing in Spain. Everyone knew that both the anarchists and the PSUC were hoarding arms, and when the fighting broke out in Barcelona, this was made clearer still. Both sides produced arms in abundance. The anarchists were well aware that even if they surrendered their arms, the PSUC, politically the main power in Catalonia, would still retain theirs. And this, in fact, was what happened after the fighting was over. Meanwhile, actually visible on the streets, there were quantities of arms which would have been very welcome at the front, but which were being retained for the non-political police forces in the rear. And underneath this, there was the irreconcilable difference between communists and anarchists, which was bound to lead to some kind of struggle sooner or later. Since the beginning of the war, the Spanish Communist Party had grown enormously in numbers and captured most of the political power. And there had come into Spain thousands of foreign communists, many of whom were openly expressing their intention of liquidating anarchism as soon as the war against Franco was won. In the circumstances, one could hardly expect the anarchists to hand over the weapons which they had got possession of in the summer of 1936. The seizure of the telephone exchange was simply the match that fired an already existing bomb. It is perhaps just conceivable that those responsible imagined that it would not lead to trouble. Companys, the Catalan president, is said to have declared laughingly a few days earlier that the anarchists would put up with anything, but certainly it was not a wise action. For months past, there had been a long series of armed clashes between communists and anarchists in various parts of Spain. Catalonia, and especially Barcelona, was in a state of tension that had already led to street affrays, assassinations, and so forth. Suddenly the news ran round the city that armed men were attacking the buildings that the workers had captured in the July fighting, and to which they attached great sentimental importance. One must remember that the civil guards were not loved by the working-class population, and the civil guards were doubly hated because they were suspected, quite justly, of being of very doubtful loyalty against the fascists. At the outbreak of war, the civil guards had everywhere sided with the stronger party. On several occasions later in the war, e.g. at Santander, the local civil guards went over to the fascists in a body. It is probable that the emotion that brought people into the streets in the first few hours was much the same emotion as had led them to resist the rebel generals at the beginning of the war. Of course, it's arguable that the CNT workers ought to have handed over the telephone exchange without protest. One's opinion here will be governed by one's attitude on the question of centralized government and working-class control. More relevantly, it may be said, yes, very likely the CNT had a case. But, after all, there was a war on, and they had no business to start a fight behind the lines. Here I agree entirely. Any internal disorder was likely to aid Franco. But what actually precipitated the fighting? The government may or may not have had the right to seize the telephone exchange. The point is that in the actual circumstances, it was bound to lead to a fight. It was a provocative action, a gesture which said in effect, and presumably was meant to say, your power is at an end, we are taking over. It wasn't common sense to expect anything but resistance. If one keeps a sense of proportion, one must realize that the fault was not, could not be, in a matter of this kind, entirely on one side. The reason why a one-sided version has been accepted is simply that the Spanish revolutionary parties have no footing in the foreign press. In the English press in particular, you would have to search for a long time before finding any favourable reference at any period of the war to the Spanish anarchists. They have been systematically denigrated, and, as I know by my own experience, it is almost impossible to get anyone to print anything in their defence. I've tried to write objectively about the Barcelona fighting, though obviously no one can be completely objective on a question of this kind. One is practically obliged to take sides, and it must be clear enough which side I am on. Again, I must inevitably have made mistakes of fact, not only here, but in other parts of this narrative. It's very difficult to write accurately about the Spanish War because of the lack of non-propagandist documents. I warn everyone against my bias, and I warn everyone against my mistakes. Still, I have done my best to be honest. But it will be seen that the account I have given is completely different from that which appeared in the foreign, and especially the communist press. It is necessary to examine the communist version, because it was published all over the world, has been supplemented at short intervals ever since, and is probably the most widely accepted one. In the communist and pro-communist press, the entire blame for the Barcelona fighting was laid upon the PUM. The affair was represented not as a spontaneous outbreak, but as a deliberate, planned insurrection against the government, engineered solely by the PUM, with the aid of a few misguided uncontrollables. More than this, it was definitely a fascist plot carried out under fascist orders, with the idea of starting civil war in the rear and thus paralysing the government. The PUM was Franco's fifth column, a Trotskyist organisation working in league with the fascists. According to the Daily Worker on the 11th of May, the German and Italian agents who poured into Barcelona ostensibly to prepare the notorious Congress of the Fourth International had one big task. It was this. They were, in cooperation with the local Trotskyists, to prepare a situation of disorder and bloodshed in which it would be possible for the Germans and Italians to declare that they were unable to exercise naval control of the Catalan coasts effectively because of the disorder prevailing in Barcelona, and were therefore unable to do otherwise than land forces in Barcelona. In other words, what was being prepared was a situation in which the German and Italian governments could land troops or marines quite openly on the Catalan coasts, declaring that they were doing so in order to preserve order. The instrument for all this lay ready to hand for the Germans and Italians in the shape of the Trotskyist organization known as the POUM. The POUM, acting in cooperation with well-known criminal elements and with certain other deluded persons in the anarchist organizations, planned, organized, and led the attack in the rearguard, accurately timed to coincide with the attack on the front at Bilbao, etc., etc. Later in the article, the Barcelona fighting becomes the POUM attack. And in another article in the same issue, it is stated that there is no doubt that it is at the door of the PUM that the responsibility for the bloodshed in Catalonia must be laid. In Preco, on the 29th of May, states that those who erected the barricades in Barcelona were only members of the PUM organized from that party for this purpose. I could quote a great deal more, but this is clear enough. The PUM was wholly responsible, and the PUM was acting under fascist orders. In a moment I will give some more extracts from the accounts that appeared in the communist press. It will be seen that they are so self-contradictory as to be completely worthless. But before doing so, it is worth pointing to several a priori reasons why this version of the May fighting as a fascist rising engineered by the PUM is next door to incredible. 1. The PUM had not the numbers or influence to provoke disorders of this magnitude. Still less had it the power to call a general strike. It was a political organization with no very definite footing in the trade unions, and it would have been hardly more capable of producing a strike throughout Barcelona than, say, the English Communist Party would be of producing a general strike throughout Glasgow. As I said earlier, the attitude of the PUM leaders may have helped to prolong the fighting to some extent, but they could not have originated it even if they had wanted to. 2. The alleged fascist plot rests on bare assertion, and all the evidence points in the other direction. We are told that the plan was for the German and Italian governments to land troops in Catalonia, but no German or Italian troopships approached the coast. As to the Congress of the Fourth International and the German and Italian agents, they're pure myth. So far as I know, there hadn't even been any talk of a Congress of the Fourth International. There were vague plans for a Congress of the POOM and its brother parties, English ILP, German SAP, etc., etc. This had been tentatively fixed for some time in July, 2 months later, and not a single delegate had yet arrived. The German and Italian agents have no existence outside the pages of the Daily Worker. Anyone who crossed the frontier at that time knows that it was not so easy to pour into Spain, or out of it, for that matter. 3. Nothing happened, either at Lérida, the chief stronghold of the POOM, or at the front. It is obvious that if the POOM leaders had wanted to aid the fascists, they would have ordered their militia to walk out of the line and let the fascists through. But nothing of the kind was done or suggested, nor were any extra men brought out of the line beforehand. Though it would have been easy enough to smuggle, say, 1,000 or 2,000 men back to Barcelona on various pretexts. And there was no attempt even at indirect sabotage of the front. The transport of food, munitions, and so forth continued as usual. I verified this by inquiry afterwards. Above all, a planned rising of the kind suggested would have needed months of preparation, subversive propaganda among the militia, and so forth, but there was no sign or rumour of any such thing. The fact that the militia at the front played no part in the rising should be conclusive. If the POOM were really planning a coup d'etat, it is inconceivable that they would not have used the 10,000 or so armed men who were the only striking force they had. It will be clear enough from this that the communist thesis of a POOM rising under fascist orders rests on less than no evidence. I will add a few more extracts from the communist press. The communist accounts of the opening incident, the raid on the telephone exchange, are illuminating. They agree in nothing except in putting the blame on the other side. It is noticeable that in the English communist papers the blame is put first upon the anarchists and only later upon the POOM. There's a fairly obvious reason for this. Not everyone in England has heard of Trotskyism, whereas every English-speaking person shudders at the name of anarchist. Let it once be known that anarchists are implicated and the right atmosphere of prejudice is established. After that, the blame can safely be transferred to the Trotskyists. The Daily Worker begins thus, on the 6th of May. A minority gang of anarchists on Monday and Tuesday seized and attempted to hold the telephone and telegram buildings and started firing into the street. There's nothing like starting off with a reversal of roles. The civil guards attack a building held by the CNT, so the CNT are represented as attacking their own building. Attacking themselves, in fact. On the other hand, the Daily Worker of the 11th of May states, the left Catalan Minister of Public Security and the United Socialist General Commissar of Public Order, Rodrigo Salas, sent the armed Republican police into the Telefonica building to disarm the employees there, most of them members of CNT unions. This doesn't seem to agree very well with the first statement. Nevertheless, the Daily Worker contains no admission that the first statement was wrong. The Daily Worker of the 11th of May states that the leaflets of the Friends of Durruti, which were disowned by the CNT, appeared on the 4th of May and the 5th of May, during the fighting. Imprecor on the 22nd of May states that they appeared on the 3rd of May before the fighting, and adds that, in view of these facts, the appearance of various leaflets, the police, led by the Prefect of Police in person, occupied the central telephone exchange in the afternoon of May the 3rd. The police were shot at while discharging their duty. This was the signal for the provocateurs to begin shooting affrays all over the city. And here is Imprecor for the 29th of May. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the Commissar for Public Security, Comrade Salas, went to the telephone exchange, which on the previous night had been occupied by 50 members of the POUM, and various uncontrollable elements. This seems rather curious. The occupation of the telephone exchange by 50 Poom members is what one might call a picturesque circumstance, and one would have expected somebody to notice it at the time, yet it appears that it was only discovered 3 or 4 weeks later. In another issue of Imprecor, the 50 Poom members become 50 Poom militiamen. It would be difficult to pack together more contradictions than are contained in these few short passages. At one moment the CNT are attacking the telephone exchange, the next they are being attacked there. A leaflet appears before the seizure of the telephone exchange and is the cause of it, or, alternatively, appears afterwards and is the result of it. The people in the telephone exchange are, alternatively, CNT members and Poom members, and so on. And in a still later issue of the Daily Worker on the 3rd of June, Mr. J.R. Campbell informs us that the government only seized the telephone exchange because the barricades were already erected. For reasons of space, I've taken only the reports of one incident, but the same discrepancies run all through the accounts in the communist press. In addition, there are various statements which are obviously pure fabrication. Here, for instance, is something quoted by the Daily Worker on the 7th of May and said to have been issued by the Spanish Embassy in Paris. A significant feature of the uprising has been that the old monarchist flag was flown from the balcony of various houses in Barcelona, doubtless in the belief that those who took part in the rising had become masters of the situation. The Daily Worker very probably reprinted this statement in good faith, but those responsible for it at the Spanish embassy must have been quite deliberately lying. Any Spaniard would understand the internal situation better than that. A monarchist flag in Barcelona? It was the one thing that could have united the warring factions in a moment. Even the communists on the spot were obliged to smile when they read about it. It is the same with the reports in the various communist papers upon the arms supposed to have been used by the Poom during the rising. They would be credible only if one knew nothing whatever of the facts. In the Daily Worker of the 17th of May, Mr. Frank Pitcairn states, "There were actually all sorts of arms used by them in the outrage. There were the arms which they have been stealing for months past and hidden, and there were arms, such as tanks, which they stole from the barracks just at the beginning of the rising. It is clear that scores of machine guns and several thousand rifles are still in their possession." Imprecor, on the 29th of May, also states, "On May the 3rd, the Poom had at its disposal some dozens of machine guns and several thousand rifles. On the Plaza de España, the Trotskyists brought into action batteries of 75 guns, which were destined for the front in Aragon and which the militia had carefully concealed on their premises." Mr. Pitcairn does not tell us how, and when it became clear that the Poom possessed scores of machine guns and several thousand rifles. I have given an estimate of the arms, which were at 3 of the principal Poom buildings, about 80 rifles, a few bombs, and no machine guns, i.e. about sufficient for the armed guards, which, at that time, all the political parties placed on their buildings. It seems strange that afterwards, when the Poom was suppressed and all its buildings seized, these thousands of weapons never came to light, especially the tanks and field guns, which are not the kind of thing that can be hidden up the chimney. But what is revealing in the two statements above is the complete ignorance they display of the local circumstances. According to Mr. Pitcairn, the Poom stole tanks from the barracks. He does not tell us which barracks. The Poom militiamen who were in Barcelona, now comparatively few as direct recruitment to the party militias had ceased, shared the Lenin barracks with a considerably larger number of popular army troops. Mr. Pitcairn is asking us to believe, therefore, that the Poom stole tanks with the connivance of the popular army. It is the same with the premises on which the 75mm guns were concealed. There is no mention of where these premises were. Those batteries of guns firing on the Plaza de España appeared in many newspaper reports, but I think we can say with certainty that they never existed. As I mentioned earlier, I heard no artillery fire during the fighting, though the Plaza de España was only a mile or so away. A few days later, I examined the Plaza de España and could find no buildings that showed marks of shell fire. And an eyewitness who was in that neighbourhood throughout the fighting declares that no guns ever appeared there. Incidentally, the tale of the stolen guns may have originated with Antonov Ovsyenko, the Russian consul general. He at any rate communicated it to a well-known English journalist, who afterwards repeated it in good faith in a weekly paper. Antonov Ovsyenko has since been purged. How this would affect his credibility, I don't know. The truth is, of course, that these tales about tanks, field guns and so forth have only been invented because otherwise it is difficult to reconcile the scale of the Barcelona fighting with the Poom's small numbers. It was necessary to claim that the Poom was wholly responsible for the fighting. It was also necessary to claim that it was an insignificant party with no following and numbered only a few thousand members, according to Imprecor. The only hope of making both statements credible was to pretend that the Poom had all the weapons of a modern mechanized army. It is impossible to read through the reports in the communist press without realizing that they are consciously aimed at a public ignorant of the facts and have no other purpose than to work up prejudice. Hence, for instance, such statements as Mr. Pitcairn's in the Daily Worker of the 11th of May that the Rising was suppressed by the popular army. The idea here is to give outsiders the impression that all Catalonia was solid against the Trotskyists. But the popular army remained neutral throughout the fighting. Everyone in Barcelona knew this. And it is difficult to believe that Mr. Pitcairn did not know it too. Or again, the juggling in the communist press with the figures for killed and wounded, with the object of exaggerating the scale of the disorders. Diaz, General Secretary of the Spanish Communist Party, widely quoted in the communist press, gave the numbers as 900 dead and 2,500 wounded. The Catalan Minister of Propaganda, who was hardly likely to underestimate, gave the numbers as 400 killed and 1,000 wounded. The Communist Party doubles the bid and adds a few more hundreds for luck. The foreign capitalist newspapers in general laid the blame for the fighting upon the anarchists, but there were a few that followed the communist line. One of these was the English News Chronicle, whose correspondent, Mr. John Langdon Davies, was in Barcelona at the time. I quote portions of his article here. A Trotskyist revolt. This has not been an anarchist uprising. It is a frustrated putsch of the Trotskyist POUM working through their controlled organizations, Friends of Durruti and Libertarian Youth. The tragedy began on Monday afternoon when the government sent armed police into the telephone building to disarm the workers there, mostly CNT men. Grave irregularities in the service had been a scandal for some time. A large crowd gathered in the Plaza de Catalunya outside, while the CNT men resisted, retreating floor by floor to the top of the building. The incident was very obscure, but word went round that the government was out against the anarchists. The streets filled with armed men. By nightfall, every workers' centre and government building was barricaded, and at 10 o'clock the first volleys were fired, and the first ambulances began ringing their way through the streets. By dawn, all Barcelona was under fire. As the day wore on, and the dead mounted to over 100, one could make a guess at what was happening. The anarchist CNT and socialist UGT were not technically out in the street. So long as they remained behind the barricades, they were merely watchfully waiting, an attitude which included the right to shoot at anything armed in the open street. The general bursts were invariably aggravated by Pacos. Hidden, solitary men, usually fascists, shooting from rooftops at nothing in particular, but doing all they could to add to the general panic. By Wednesday evening, however, it began to be clear who was behind the revolt. All the walls had been plastered with an inflammatory poster calling for an immediate revolution and for the shooting of Republican and Socialist leaders. It was signed by the Friends of Durruti. On Thursday morning, the Anarchist Daily denied all knowledge or sympathy with it, but La Batalla, the POUM paper, reprinted the document with the highest praise. Barcelona, the first city of Spain, was plunged into bloodshed by agents provocateurs using this subversive organization. This does not agree very completely with the communist versions I quoted above, but it will be seen that even as it stands, it's self-contradictory. First, the affair is described as a Trotskyist revolt. Then it is shown to have resulted from a raid on the telephone building and the general belief that the government was out against the anarchists. The city is barricaded, and both CNT and UGT are behind the barricades. 2 days afterwards, the inflammatory poster, actually a leaflet, appears, and this is declared by implication to have started the whole business. Effect preceding cause. But there is a piece of very serious misrepresentation here. Mr. Langdon Davies describes the Friends of Durruti and Libertarian Youth as controlled organizations of the PUM. Both were anarchist organizations and had no connection with the PUM. The Libertarian Youth was the Youth League of the Anarchists, corresponding to the JSU of the PSUC, etc. The Friends of Durruti was a small organization within the FAI and was, in general, bitterly hostile to the POUM. So far as I can discover, there was no one who was a member of both. It would be about equally true to say that the Socialist League is a controlled organization of the English Liberal Party. Was Mr. Langdon Davies unaware of this? If he was, he should have written with more caution about this very complex subject. I'm not attacking Mr. Langdon Davies's good faith, but admittedly he left Barcelona as soon as the fighting was over, i.e. at the moment when he could have begun serious inquiries, and throughout his report there are clear signs that he has accepted the official version of a Trotskyist revolt without sufficient verification. This is obvious even in the extract I've quoted. By nightfall the barricades are built, and at 10 o'clock, the first volleys are fired. These are not the words of an eyewitness. From this, you would gather that it is usual to wait for your enemy to build a barricade before beginning to shoot at him. The impression given is that some hours elapsed between the building of the barricades and the firing of the first volleys, whereas, naturally, it was the other way about. I and many others saw the first volleys fired early in the afternoon. Again, there are the solitary men, usually fascists, who are shooting from the rooftops. Mr. Langdon Davies doesn't explain how he knew that these men were fascists. Presumably he didn't climb onto the roofs and ask them. He's simply repeating what he's been told. And as it fits in with the official version, he's not questioning it. As a matter of fact, he indicates one probable source of much of his information by an incautious reference to the Minister of Propaganda at the beginning of his article. Foreign journalists in Spain were hopelessly at the mercy of the Minister of Propaganda, though one would think that the very name of this ministry would be a sufficient warning. The Minister of Propaganda was, of course, about as likely to give an objective account of the Barcelona trouble as, say, the late Lord Carson would have been to give an objective account of the Dublin Rising of 1916. I have given reasons for thinking that the communist version of the Barcelona fighting cannot be taken seriously. In addition, I must say something about the general charge that the PUM was a secret fascist organization in the pay of Franco and Hitler. This charge was repeated over and over in the communist press, especially from the beginning of 1937 onwards. It was part of the worldwide drive of the official Communist Party against Trotskyism, of which the PUM was supposed to be representative in Spain. Trotskyism, according to Frente Rojo, the Valencia communist paper, is not a political doctrine. Trotskyism is an official capitalist organization, a fascist terrorist band occupied in crime and sabotage against the people. The PUM was a Trotskyist organization in league with the fascists and part of Franco's Fifth Column. What was noticeable from the start was that no evidence was produced in support of this accusation. The thing was simply asserted with an air of authority, and the attack was made with the maximum of personal libel and with complete irresponsibility as to any effects it might have upon the war. Compared with the job of libeling the PUM, Many communist writers appear to have considered the betrayal of military secrets unimportant. In a February number of the Daily Worker, for instance, a writer, Winifred Bates, is allowed to state that the POOM had only half as many troops on its section of the front as it pretended. This was not true, but presumably the writer believed it to be true. She and the Daily Worker were perfectly willing, therefore, to hand to the enemy one of the most important pieces of information that can be handed through the columns of a newspaper. In the New Republic, Mr. Ralph Bates stated that the POOM troops were playing football with the fascists in no man's land, at a time when, as a matter of fact, the POOM troops were suffering heavy casualties and a number of my personal friends were killed and wounded. Again, there was the malignant cartoon, which was widely circulated, first in Madrid and later in Barcelona, representing the POOM as slipping off a mask marked with the hammer and sickle and revealing a face marked with the swastika. Had the government not been virtually under communist control, it would never have permitted a thing of this kind to be circulated in wartime. It was a deliberate blow at the morale not only of the POOM militia, but of any others who happened to be near them, for it is not encouraging to be told that the troops next to you in the line are traitors. As a matter of fact, I doubt whether the abuse that was heaped upon them from the rear actually had the effect of demoralizing the POOM militia, but certainly it was calculated to do so, and those responsible for it must be held to have put political spite before anti-fascist unity. The accusation against the POOM amounted to this: that a body of some scores of thousands of people, almost entirely working class, besides numerous foreign helpers and sympathisers, mostly refugees from fascist countries, and thousands of militia, was simply a vast spying organisation in fascist pay. The thing was opposed to common sense, and the past history of the POOM was enough to make it incredible. All the POOM leaders had revolutionary histories behind them. Some of them had been mixed up in the 1934 revolt, and most of them had been imprisoned for socialist activities under the LaRue government or the monarchy. In 1936, the then leader, Joaquin Morin, was one of the deputies who gave warning in the Cortes of Franco's impending revolt. Sometime after the outbreak of war, he was taken prisoner by the fascists while trying to organize resistance in Franco's rear. When the revolt broke out, the POOM played a conspicuous part in resisting it, and in Madrid in particular, many of its members were killed in the street fighting. It was one of the first bodies to form columns of militia in Catalonia and Madrid. It seems almost impossible to explain these as the actions of a party in fascist pay. A party in fascist pay would simply have joined in on the other side. Nor was there any sign of pro-fascist activities during the war. It was arguable, though finally I do not agree, that by pressing for a more revolutionary policy, the POOM divided the government forces and thus aided the fascists. I think any government of reformist type would be justified in regarding a party like the POOM as a nuisance. But this is a very different matter from direct treachery. There is no way of explaining why, if the POOM was really a fascist body, its militia remained loyal. Here were 8,000 or 10,000 men holding important parts of the line during the intolerable conditions of the winter of 1936-37. Many of them were in the trenches 4 or 5 months at a stretch. It is difficult to see why they did not simply walk out of the line or go over to the enemy. It was always in their power to do so, and at times the effect might have been decisive, yet they continued to fight. And it was shortly after the POOM was suppressed as a political party, when the event was fresh in everyone's mind, that the militia, not yet redistributed among the popular army, took part in the murderous attack to the east of Huesca, when several thousand men were killed in 1 or 2 days. At the very least, one would have expected fraternization with the enemy and a constant trickle of deserters. But, as I have pointed out earlier, the number of desertions was exceptionally small. Again, one would have expected pro-fascist propaganda, defeatism, and so forth, yet there was no sign of any such thing. Obviously, there must have been fascist spies and agents provocateurs in the POOM. They exist in all left-wing parties, but there is no evidence that there were more of them than there were elsewhere. It is true that some of the attacks in the communist press said rather grudgingly that only the POOM leaders were in fascist pay and not the rank and file, But this was merely an attempt to detach the rank and file from their leaders. The nature of the accusation implied that ordinary members, militiamen and so forth, were all in the plot together. For it was obvious that if Nin, Gorkin and the others were really in fascist pay, it was more likely to be known to their followers than to journalists in London, Paris and New York. And in any case, when the POOM was suppressed, the communist-controlled secret police acted on the assumption that all were guilty alike and arrested everyone connected with the POOM whom they could lay hands on, including even wounded men, hospital nurses, wives of POOM members, and in some cases even children. Finally, on the 15th and 16th of June, the POOM was suppressed and declared an illegal organization. This was one of the first acts of the Negrin government, which came into office in May. When the executive committee of the POOM had been thrown into jail, the communist press produced what purported to be the discovery of an enormous fascist plot. For a while, the communist press of the whole world was flaming with this kind of thing. Here's the Daily Worker on the 21st of June, summarizing various Spanish communist papers. Spanish Trotskyists plot with Franco. Following the arrest of a large number of leading Trotskyists in Barcelona and elsewhere, there became known over the weekend details of one of the most ghastly pieces of espionage ever known in wartime and the ugliest revelation of Trotskyist treachery to date. Documents in the possession of the police, together with the full confession of no less than 200 persons under arrest, prove, etc., etc. What these revelations proved was that the POOM leaders were transmitting military secrets to General Franco by radio, were in touch with Berlin, and were acting in collaboration with the secret fascist organization in Madrid. In addition, there were sensational details about secret messages in invisible ink, a mysterious document signed with the letter N, standing for Nin, and so on and so forth. But the final upshot was this. 6 months after the event, as I write, most of the POOM leaders are still in jail, but they have never been brought to trial, and the charges of communicating with Franco by radio, etc., have never even been formulated. Had they really been guilty of espionage, they would have been tried and shot in a week, as so many fascist spies had been previously. But not a scrap of evidence was ever produced except the unsupported statements in the communist press. As for the 200 full confessions, which, if they had existed, would have been enough to convict anybody, they have never been heard of again. They were, in fact, 200 efforts of somebody's imagination. More than this, most of the members of the Spanish government have disclaimed all belief in the charges against the POOM. Recently, the cabinet decided by 5-2 in favour of releasing anti-fascist political prisoners, the two dissentients being the communist ministers. In August, an international delegation headed by James Maxton MP went to Spain to inquire into the charges against the POOM and the disappearance of Andrés Nin, Prieto, the Minister of National Defence, Irujo, the Minister of Justice, Zuga Zagoitia, Minister of the Interior, Ortega y Gasset, the Procurator General, Prat Garcia, and others all repudiated any belief in the POOM leaders being guilty of espionage. Irujo added that he had been through the dossier of the case, that none of the so-called pieces of evidence would bear examination, and that the document supposed to have been signed by Nin was valueless, i.e., a forgery. Prieto considered the POOM leaders to be responsible for the May fighting in Barcelona, but dismissed the idea of their being fascist spies. What is most grave, he added, is that the arrest of the POOM leaders was not decided upon by the government, and the police carried out these arrests on their own authority. Those responsible are not the heads of the police, but their entourage, which has been infiltrated by the communists according to their usual custom. He cited other cases of illegal arrests by the police. Irujo likewise declared that the police had become quasi-independent and were in reality under the control of foreign communist elements. Prieto hinted fairly broadly to the delegation that the government could not afford to offend the Communist Party while the Russians were supplying arms. When another delegation, headed by John McGovern MP, went to Spain in December, they got much the same answers as before, and Zuga Zagoyetilla, the Minister of the Interior, repeated Prieto's hint in even plainer terms. We have received aid from Russia and have had to permit certain actions which we do not like. As an illustration of the autonomy of the police, it is interesting to learn that even with a signed order from the Director of Prisons and the Minister of Justice, McGovern and the others could not obtain admission to one of the secret prisons maintained by the Communist Party in Barcelona.